It's 12:37 on the Afternoon Magazine. In for Celeste Quinn today, I'm Tom Rogers. We're watching a weak disturbance producing mostly cloudy but dry conditions over the area today. A low-pressure system is approaching from the west, though, and that means some light snow across parts of Missouri and southern Iowa this afternoon, and it then moves to the east from there. Macon and DeWitt counties are going to be under a winter weather advisory beginning at 6 o'clock this evening. Then much of the rest of our severe weather coverage area will be under that advisory starting at midnight tonight as the snow starts to drift toward the east. The snow will continue through the day tomorrow before it gradually comes to an end tomorrow night. Widespread 3 to 5-inch snowfall amounts will be common in northern and central Missouri, eastward across parts of central Illinois and Indiana. Lighter totals found further north with little or no snow falling north of the I-80 corridor. So while most of our coverage area is under a winter weather advisory, McLean, Ford, and Iroquois are not included in that advisory. The other counties will be in that advisory beginning at midnight tonight. And as I mentioned, DeWitt and Macon County will see snow a little bit earlier with their watch advisory coming up at 6 o'clock. The forecast for Champaign-Urbana for the rest of today, cloudy skies, the high 28, northwest winds at 5 to 10 miles an hour. For tonight, the chance of snow moves in, and then after midnight, snow will be likely and we could see 1 to 2 inches by the time we wake up tomorrow. The low tonight, 19 degrees with light northwest winds. Tomorrow, snow in the morning, then a chance of snow in the afternoon before it tapers off. Snow accumulation tomorrow of 1 to 2 inches. That means 2 to 4 total for the Champaign-Urbana area. The high tomorrow, 23 with northwest winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour. Then the bottom drops out of the temperature, turning colder Thursday night, mostly cloudy, low 1 above, and northwest winds at 15 to 20, creating wind chill readings 5 to 15 below zero. For Friday, mostly sunny, the high 13 with the lowest wind chill readings in the morning, anywhere between 3 and 13 below. Southwest winds on Friday at 5 to 10 miles an hour. Looking ahead from there, mostly cloudy Friday night through Tuesday, maybe a little chance of snow reappearing on Monday. High Saturday in the low 20s, Sunday in the mid-20s, and Monday in the upper 20s. Taking a look at the current readings around our area and our part of the state, in Decatur, it's cloudy and 22 degrees. Flurries reported in Bloomington at the top of the hour in 22. In Springfield, 20 degrees. Danville, 25, as well as Rantoul, Mattoon, 24, 28 in Paris. And at Willard Airport, a few flurries and 26 degrees at the top of the hour. Northwest wind at 10, making the wind chill 16. There was a little bit of fog reported in the area as well. The dew point, 22. Relative humidity, 84%. The pressure falling at 30.09. On Friends Plaza, it's 25 degrees. It's 20 minutes before 1 o'clock. Illinois senior senator, the second in command among Democrats in the Senate, says concrete action can come out of the recent shootings at a congressional event in Tucson, Arizona. The attack killed 6 people and critically injured Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. It's led to a flurry of proposals in reaction, from gun control measures to a clampdown on incivility in politics. But Dick Durbin thinks some of those ideas can progress beyond the talking stage. He sat down with me for a one-on-one interview yesterday.
Well, there are 3 things that come to mind immediately. This shooter was mentally unstable. We need to be constantly aware of the fact that there are people in America suffering from serious forms of mental illness who could be a danger to themselves and others. In this situation, he was asked to leave a community college because they thought he was dangerous, and that was the end of the story. He could still buy a firearm and apparently not be held to any kind of standard of conduct, despite the fact that they didn't want him around. They were concerned about him. We've got to have a more honest approach to mental illness in this country, and we've got to understand that cutbacks in some budgetary items could reduce the type of oversight and the type of supervision people like that desperately need.
Is that a state jurisdiction or a federal jurisdiction?
Both.
Because the criticism has been over Arizona's amount of mental health services. Illinois has gone through the same kind of discussion.
Both. It's literally both. It is a matter not only of people qualifying for federal assistance, whether it's Medicaid or some form of disability assistance, but also the fact they need professional help. I had a bill that I introduced after the tragedy at Northern Illinois University just a few years back that really put more resources on campus. So many times these problems of mental illness are manifest in late adolescence and the first time a young man or woman is away from family. And I think campuses and colleges need more resources to deal with it. The second area, of course, relates to guns. And I'm not going to get into a Second Amendment debate. I could, but I don't think it would take us very far. A couple things do come out pretty clear to me. Number one, if someone is so mentally unstable they couldn't qualify for the military and they're being asked to leave a community college, how can they purchase a firearm with impunity? And that's what happened in this circumstance. We've got to do better. And another aspect of it, you know, how many bullets do you need to fire off at any given time? This man had 90 bullets in three or four different clips he was carrying. They stopped him after he fired the first 20. He was on to use the rest of them. And I think there ought to be some limitation on the size of the clips that are sold to people in ordinary commerce.
Does this give a push to the restoration of the Brady Law or something short of that, perhaps, or anything?
I support the Brady Law, and I support background checks when people are buying guns to make sure that they aren't mentally unstable and they're not going to use the guns for criminal purposes. But let's be honest. In this Congress, the way it is composed politically, it's not likely there'll be many things done. I just hope that we can get some things done to reduce the misuse of firearms by people who aren't buying them for self-defense or for sporting purpose.
What would be the bare minimum then? What would you want to see?
Well, perhaps it's the clips. To reduce the size of the clips that are for sale. One Republican congressman, Peter King in New York, has suggested no one could carry a firearm into a political event. And I think that makes sense, too. I'm not just saying that for a self-serving purpose, but whether it's a member of the city council or Congress, I just don't see the need to have a firearm in that place.
With all the talk that was generated by the shootings about the tone of rhetoric, the incivility, how do you draw a line between incivility and just plain old spirited dialogue? And what might be the future impact of some of these initiatives that are coming out, including, you know, senators sitting together and the State of the Union address next week? What might be the fallout of that?
Well, I don't think you can really associate the terrible things that occurred in Tucson with anyone's political rhetoric. That man was mentally unstable, and I'm not sure what pushed him over the edge. I don't think it was any politician's speech or slogan or advertisement that did it. But I think we all understand that there is a coarsening of the political rhetoric in America at too many levels. Radio talk shows and television cable shows and even the speeches of members of Congress and other politicians. You know, it's time for us to step back and show a little more respect for one another, both left and right. And I think if we do, that it will set a good example for people to do the same in their dealings with politicians. I'd also suggest that we really ought to tone down the references to firearms and explosions and war-type maneuvers in the course of a campaign. It's too easy to fall into it and to suggest a violent response to a political position you may disagree with.
And you can hear the rest of Senator Dick Durbin's interview coming up on our website at will.illinois.edu. It's there now. It includes Durbin's views on the health care overhaul and judicial nominations that are awaiting action in the U.S. Senate. It's 12:45. Diehard music fans of a certain age will remember Don Kirshner, the music publisher and producer who helped to bring hundreds of hits to radio and television. Kirshner died of heart failure Monday in Boca Raton, Florida, at the age of 76. We have a remembrance from NPR's Netta Ulaby.
Don Kirshner once told an interviewer, "I can't tell you how good my life story is, but the songs will make a great soundtrack."
Everybody's doing a brand.
Say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
You are the love.
He really was one of the greatest publishers ever.
That's Cynthia Weil. She co-wrote You've Lost That Loving Feeling with her husband, Barry Mann. Don Kirshner signed them to his music publishing company when they were in their early 20s.
All of his writers were like a pack of crazy kids who all wanted to talk to him.
Kirshner's writers included Carole King, Neil Sedaka, Neil Diamond. And Cynthia Weil says they'd all camp out in front of his office in the Brill Building to get his attention.
And I remember once chasing after him and getting halfway into the men's room before we both realized where he was and where I was and that I didn't belong there.
Splish, splash, I was taking a bath.
Singer Bobby Darin was Kirshner's ticket into the music industry. They met right after high school, and let's fast forward to 1959. Bobby Darin's on a famous show that reunited celebrities with people from their pasts. It's This Is Your Life, and they've hit the point when Darin turned 18.
And you find a songwriting partner, and here he is now. Now president of Nevins Kirshner Music Limited from New York City, you were best man at his wedding, Donnie Kirshner.
The singer and his producer reminisced with the host, Ralph Edwards, about their start trying to write songs.
Together. How many, Donnie?
Well, we wrote about 25, Ralph, and 10 of them were published. None of them were real big hits.
They were bombs.
That's they were bombs.
From that humble beginning, Kirshner built a publishing and recording powerhouse so successful he sold it in 1961 to Columbia. He became president of one of its music divisions. There he laid the foundation of a legacy in prefab pop. It was Kirshner who helped assemble the Monkees, and later, the Archies, an animated group on the kids' TV show that sold over 6 million copies of this. Sugar. Don Kirshner was visionary when it came to music on TV. That's not to say he was loose or charismatic hosting it.
Canada is stirring musically, and one of the forerunners of action from the North is the boogieing group The Guess Who.
The New Yorker's music editor, Ben Greenman, barely remembers Kirshner's two TV shows from the 1970s, In Concert and Rock Concert, when they were first broadcast. But, he says, go to YouTube and you'll thank Kirshner for some of the earliest TV appearances of a ton of great rock bands. Led Zeppelin, Sly and the Family Stone, The Police.
There's just no end to it. If you go back and look, it's a little museum of everything that was good.
Displaying high energy and excitement, here they are, New York's own, The Ramones.
Don Kirshner was part of a generation of older music executives who kept an ear glued to the ground and a heart spread wide when it came to the music that young people loved. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
I'm Carl Caldwell, and I've been a lifelong student of American Civil War history. In 2011, I invite you to join me on a journey to benefit WILL. We'll ride vintage rail cars to battlefields and exhibits in Chicago, D.C., Gettysburg, and more. Civil War train departs for 8 days, beginning July 16th. For more information, phone 217-333-7300.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 19th of January, 2011. It's the birthday of Julian Barnes, the novelist born in Leicester, England, 1946, nominated for the Booker Prize 3 times for his novels Flaubert's Parrot, England, England, and Arthur and George. Also the author of a memoir, Nothing to be Frightened Of. Julian Barnes, who said of literature,